Well, I want to begin this Easter sermon with a true story that I shared with you a few years ago, but I think that it bears repeating. And though it is a personal story, I think that it reflects an aspect of the journey of faith and belief that many of you gathered here today may have experienced. It was the summer of 1997, 17 years ago now, that I was interviewed by the pastor nominating committee of Bethany Presbyterian Church in Dallas. Bethany was a small congregation, and the only one in Grace Presbytery that had officially associated itself with the inclusive More Light Presbyterian network of churches, just as College Hill is the only congregation in Eastern Oklahoma Presbytery to have done so. Well, needless to say, that congregation in Dallas considered itself to be quite progressive, both theologically as well as socially. And I also considered myself to be progressive as well. But during the interview process, I was asked the following question. Would you have a problem with someone who serves as an elder on the session who doesn't believe in the literal bodily resurrection of Jesus? I still clearly remember my response to the person who asked that question, rightfully discerning that he was the one with that question. I said, I personally have no reason not to believe it. But no, I wouldn't have a problem with someone who doesn't believe in it, the literal resurrection. Well, this exchange made me realize that while someone can be considered quite progressive in one setting, he or she could be considered almost traditional in another. And you may have experienced this yourself. Well, upon further discussion with that pastor nominating committee, I learned that a former interim pastor at that church preached an Easter sermon some years before, making the bold statement that unless a person believed the resurrection story literally, as in a bodily, physical resurrection, they had no right to even call themselves a Christian. And there's probably a majority of Christians today who still believe that. And for that interim pastor, it was a requirement for consideration to identify oneself as a Christian. But even all those years ago, I held to a position that believing anything literally in the Bible wasn't a prerequisite in and of itself to call oneself a Christian. Rather, being a Christian, in my opinion, is more about considering oneself a follower of Jesus and the ways of Jesus. Calling oneself a Christian involves looking to Jesus as the definitive revelation, but not necessarily the only one, to help us discern the nature and character of God. So my own understanding of what it means to be a Christian is obviously much broader and more inclusive than those who require certain beliefs like the literal physical resurrection of Jesus. But to be fair to that interim pastor who preached that Easter sermon, I truly believe that he was speaking as a person of faith, with a strong conviction that this was his best understanding of God's will. And as you know, that particular belief concerning resurrection was a position which I held to dearly myself. I no longer believe, however, that Christianity falls apart if one doesn't believe in a literal bodily resurrection. Therefore, it's further proof to me that a life of faith is not so much about absolute certainty as it is about embracing the mystery of the divine and understanding oneself on being on a remarkable journey where even our deepest held beliefs can be challenged and perhaps even changed. And it's also a reminder to those of us who call ourselves inclusive that we must not, in turn, judge and condemn those with different theological, social, and political perspectives, even if we have been judged and condemned by them. That's one of those ways of Jesus. borrow a phrase from the Apostle Paul, though we can find ourselves at different ends of the theological spectrum, for the most part, we are both simply trying to speak the truth in love to one another. But as Pontius Pilate is recorded in the Gospel of John to have asked Jesus, "What is truth?" Well, most of us raised in the Western world over the past 200 years have been taught to equate truth with literal, historical, verifiable facts. But what if there is a different kind of truth? A truth that is filled with mystery and ambiguity, and less absolute from a literal perspective. A truth revealed by metaphorical and symbolic language that points to a deeper truth. This is what lies at the very heart of progressive Christianity: having the right and the willingness to question long-held traditional understandings of church doctrines and biblical interpretations, while respecting intellectual integrity through the use of the latest in biblical, scientific, and social knowledge and understanding. Yes, I realize that I am channeling the late Reverend Dr. Harold Hill at this point, but he taught me a lot. If we continue to allow the church to be unyielding and dogmatic, which it has been through most of its history, what is the inevitable outcome? Well, in effect, if the church survives or continues to be relevant in any way to a growing number of Americans, what the above example reflects is the imposition of, quote, an institutional monopoly on access to God. A favorite phrase of mine was used by Jesus seminar author Marcus Bohr to explain how organized religion throughout the ages imposes certain requirements in order for people, in their opinion, to have full access to the love, grace, mercy, and redemption of God. And so important has this concept become to me that I now see this as a primary guiding force in my own ministry: to do what I can to help dismantle this notion that the church has a right to an institutional monopoly on access to God. The church must put an end to its endless litmus tests that it has used and continues to use to determine whether someone is a legitimate person of faith. And as I mentioned earlier, there was a time not too long ago when I didn't have a reason to question the literal interpretation of the Easter stories of Jesus' resurrection from the dead. Once the seed was planted, however, that there are other legitimate ways to look at and interpret these resurrection narratives, including that perhaps the biblical authors themselves knew they were writing in metaphorical language, not literal, I allowed myself to explore, question, and eventually change my mind from a previous literal understanding. But notice that I use the phrase "changed my mind," because that's what it was. The conscious, personal choice to reflect upon the experience of my own journey of faith and reevaluate my previously held convictions. So that is the message that I bring to you on this Easter. Not to tell you what to believe, or to try to force the changing of your mind in relation to your own theological understandings and biblical interpretations, but rather to simply warn that the church's list of fundamental belief requirements that imposes an institutional monopoly on access to God is what I believe Jesus' own life and ministry tried to dismantle. Jesus challenged the Jewish temple system that required prescribed sacrifices that they believed were necessary in order for God to forgive them. This, among other challenges of Jesus to the powers that be, led to his execution. Yet within the first century after his death, the newly formed Christian movement started prescribing its own requirements on access to God. Requirements that were engraved in granite by Roman Emperor Constantine's conclave that resulted in the Nicene Creed in the early 4th century. And throughout the following centuries, the Roman Catholic Church continued to build on this list of requirements, dropping some and adding others. The Protestant Reformation that began in the early 1500s sought in part to put an end to that monopoly. They did this by emphasizing God's grace, God's unmerited grace that didn't require the mediation of the clergy to allow people access to the presence of God. Yet not soon after Luther and Calvin, that became the new requirement. That in order to have full access to the love, grace, and redemption of God, a person had to believe in this newly prescribed understanding of God's grace. And so the cycle continued. And to this day, I would suspect that a majority of Christians think that the only legitimate way to interpret the Easter event is in a literal, physical, bodily resurrection. To think, if taken to its logical and literal conclusion, that means that Jesus is still somewhere out there physically. And saying that Jesus is physically sitting at the right hand of God makes no sense either. As if God is located at some specific spot, somewhere up there. That, to many 21st century folks, just isn't a realistic belief. And if forced to believe it in order to be part of a congregation, they have chosen to leave the church altogether. Yet there is still an enormous amount of fear that anything but the traditional, literal interpretation may result in the ultimate punishment, eternal banishment in hell. More and more Christians, however, are questioning that ancient concept as well. Now, including some of those who identify themselves as being on the evangelical end of the theological spectrum. So just think of the ramifications on the institutional monopoly on access to God if Christianity were to remove the threat of eternal damnation. That continues to be a club used by people to beat others into submission. And it is something for which most of organized religion is not yet willing to let go. So what if God really is a God of love and grace? A grace that is extended to all people throughout all time with all beliefs. And not just to those who prescribe a list of requirements and specific beliefs in order to be recipients of that grace. The irony, of course, is that really isn't grace at all if you have to believe certain things before you can receive that grace. Now, none of this means, however, that there aren't certain paths and understanding that lead to living life more fully, to loving more abundantly, and to being who God has created us to be. But it does serve to help dismantle the institutional monopoly on access to God. If you agree, and you are not required to do so, then I'll leave you with this question. What can you do personally? And what can we do together as a congregation to help in this process of dismantling the institutional monopoly on access to God? Perhaps that's the meaning of Easter itself, that no one has a monopoly on access to God, including us. Amen.